Welcome to Casa de Cambio. On today's episode of Casa de Cambio, I am so excited to be joined by Gavin Waddell. Welcome, Gavin.
Hey, thank you. I'm delighted to join the Casa. Let's do some cambio.
Yes. And we are going to talk about some amazing and insightful research that you've done and how people respond to change and how you can tailor your engagement responses or engagement interventions based on how people respond. But before we get into that, there's two questions I ask every guest who comes onto the podcast. And the first one is, what are you currently watching, reading, or listening to?
That's interesting you asked this question. I was actually on a call with a customer in the US this morning, and I was flicking between screens as I was sharing my screen. And you know, when you hit Alt and Tab, you can see all of the windows that you've got open.
Yes.
So I had a window with South Park open, right? Because I've been watching the latest episode of South Park, which is called Entering the Pandatron. The reason I mention this is, firstly, it was embarrassing, so that's always amusing. But interestingly, in that episode, one of the characters, Randy Marsh, starts to become disillusioned because everyone's jobs are starting to be replaced by AI, and the only people that actually have jobs are the people who can actually fix stuff with their hands.
Oh my God.
I wonder if there's something in that for all of us, you know, all of the knowledge work's being taken up by AI.
That show sometimes is so on point with their social observations. I'm going to watch that, but I now want to ask you, what's your favorite South Park episode of all time? Do you have like a, you know, some top fives that are jumping to mind?
I mean, I'm a big fan, so I'd probably say the episode where, goodness me, how controversial should we be? I mean, there's a few great episodes.
Look, I'll start. My favorite episode is the human centipad, so you can do what you want with that info about me. So now you are free to talk about.
Okay, yep, that was the Steve Jobs one there. There was the one where John Travolta and Tom Cruise are in the closet.
Oh, they won't come out.
The Scientology episode was pretty funny. Another favorite is, just the first episode where Cartman has a big satellite coming out of him,
which is
ridiculous.
Yeah.
The episode with Randy Marsh in it tends to be, they're going to just their kids play and he treats it as an opportunity to fight with anyone that's there. pretty much every episode is good.
So the last South Park episode I watched, because it's one of those shows that I loved and you kind of forget that it's still going, but I think Randy has started a marijuana farm with Towley, and he was getting really frustrated because everybody smokes weed all the time. They've become lazy and weren't doing anything, which now I'm not describing it in a way that's funny, but it was very funny. Anyway, we were already going off on tangents about South Park, but this is what I love about this question, because you know that people who are in the C-suite love watching South Park. Sometimes, of course, we read lots of very serious books about change in business, but, you know, this is, I actually really enjoy it when people talk about, I guess, show like relaxation and lol shows. Let's talk about the way people respond to change. So I know that you've done some amazing research, but also you've done some work around some of the types of responses. So could you walk me through some of the ways that people respond to change?
Yeah, sure. A model that I think is particularly useful, and bearing in mind that, you know, models are not exact replications of reality, but a model that we've had a lot of success using is the idea that there are four typical responses to change. And the reason that this is super helpful is because it's simple. So you can share this with leaders, with people who are new to change as well, to help them get a sense of the way that different audience groups are likely to respond. So what we tend to find is that there are these four responses. The first are the critics, people who are really upset about what's happening. They're angry. They're openly hostile. They'll do everything they can to subvert the change in an obvious way. It's a terrible idea. Now, they're a damaging group to change success, but they're probably not the worst group that you might encounter. The second response to change that we typically see are the bystanders. So people who will go out of their way to not do anything when the change is happening.
Yeah.
And I must admit, I'm a bit of a bystander when there are changes. I'll do my best to not be involved.
Yeah. I think in Australia, we are masters of passive avoidance. Like, we will smile and nod in the meeting and we won't directly challenge or, you know, or we may ask some questions, but then the meeting will finish and everyone will be like, ugh, as if, and then, you know, but we make it look like, yep, we're participating, but then we don't. And I'm not explaining it well, but I think, and like,
no, you are. That's exactly what happens.
Well, you wouldn't think, as you'd think Australians would be a lot more direct in the workplace given our reputation, but it's quite the phenomenon here.
We're all very collegial people. We want to be nice and friendly and be, you know, helpful to our colleagues. So we'll all say, oh, yeah, that's a great idea. But at the end of the day, oftentimes we will do anything we can to avoid having to change. Mm. So I think the bystanders are particularly difficult people to engage. You know, they will smile and nod. They'll say that they'll do everything, they won't. So you've got your critics, you've got your bystanders. The third response to change, and these are people that I probably have the most empathy for, and I think we really need to focus on, are people who feel victimized by a particular change.
Mm.
So they're essentially anxious and fearful that they won't be able to cope with the future state. So they're scared, they've got that, you know, amygdala hijack, they've got that fear factor, that threat response going on. And it could be that that's because the change hasn't been communicated particularly well.
Yeah.
It could be that they simply are feeling concerned because it's a new system, a new platform, and they feel that they might have difficulty learning it. But it's probably the group that out of everyone is most concerned and is going through the tallest change journey, if you will, you know, in terms of the roller coaster that they're going through.
Yeah, surprise change is another reason people can take on the victim mentality is, and you mentioned the amygdala hijack. So if you are hearing of something for the first time and it's a change that you think is quite high impact to you, or you're a bit scared of it, then you can have that amygdala hijack, and then you will have a fight or flight response and you will take on a victim mentality. And I think one of the ones that's springing to mind is restructures. They're done in secret. And then all of a sudden you're pulled into a meeting with your manager and a HR person and you're told you don't have a job anymore. And you usually end up dealing with it because it's completely out of your control, but it's not a very nice, and I've had one of those conversations and I had a suspicion it was coming and I was still very surprised when it actually happened. You know, and so for some people, like, this is their job, this is their livelihood. So finding out that sort of information with no warning, like, you go into work, you're having a great morning, and then all of a sudden, what? So that's the example that I think springs to mind. And another thing that, you know, I know we're going to get onto the other types, but I think the victim type, and stop me if I'm getting ahead of you, the chat, but I think that's probably one that can be influenced by managing the change well. Right? Yeah. Okay. And anyway, go on.
No, you're absolutely right. So the victim is definitely a group that we need to cater to really specifically. We'll talk about how we can cater to the victims, but it's surprising how many people are victims. But just in relation to your example there, if you're pulled into a meeting and told that your job is no longer relevant or your job is no longer part of the organization, obviously we're going to be critics, we're going to be victims, we're going to feel angry. So that's going to be a difficult piece. But there are also a lot of circumstances in which people feel victimized, even when their job is secure, but they just feel anxious because they don't know what to do next. And I know that a lot of people at the beginning of COVID suddenly felt extremely anxious because they had to work from home, they had to do things completely differently. They had to suddenly get on board with new technology sets that they weren't used to.
I hated working from home. I hated it at the start. And now I can't imagine going into the office 5 days a week. I cannot believe I used to do that.
It's an incredible shift in just how the world interacts with work, the fact that we can collaborate, we can contribute, we can do it so effortlessly, and the fact that it happened so quickly. It's actually amazing that COVID struck when it did, because 10 years prior, we didn't really have the kind of comms that we would have needed. So it's a bizarre kind of coincidence that it occurred just when Teams and Zoom were getting really, you know, decent to actually use for video conferencing. But the final response to change is the navigator. So you've got your critic, you've got your bystander, your victim, and then your navigator. And your navigator essentially is someone who can see, oh, I get why this change is happening. I understand what I need to do. It's kind of a growth mindset approach. Oh, let's move on with this. Let's try and interact. Let's try and make the best of this. We'll participate in the journey. And, you know, someone might go through all of those approaches or those responses to change, you know, have in a particular sequence. But what we ultimately want to do is we want to minimize the amount of time that people are critics, bystanders, and victims, and then move everyone to navigator state as soon as possible.
Yeah. Yeah. So I have a lot of thoughts, but I want to ask, since you're the guest, rather than say what my thoughts are, what do you recommend depending? Okay. Well, actually, before we get into what your recommendations are, I want to ask, what are some of the signs that someone is a critic versus a navigator? Because, you know, some people may be trying to work out how is this going to work in the future, which means they've accepted the change, but maybe it's coming across wrong or they're being unfairly labeled. So could you give a little bit of information if you're someone who's leading change or a change practitioner or a change agent? Like, how would, I mean, we talked a bit about the victim, I think, but how would you define, like, what might be some things that people might say or give you a clue as to which group they would be sitting in?
Sure. I mean, you can just use your emotional intelligence for the first piece. So look at people, how they're responding when you're telling them about the change. Listen to the tone of their voice when they're asking questions about the change. Critics are great because you'll typically know who the critics are going to be. Often they're people whose jobs are going to be changed the most, or they might stand to lose power status because they're some sort of legacy systems expert. Those are the people that are likely to be contributors. Just watch for the tone of their voice when they're asking questions. We always want to encourage questions, of course. We always want to encourage people participating and giving their thoughts and contributions. It's just the critics will make it known that this is a bad idea, and they'll list any number of reasons why it's a terrible idea. They'll also try and pull people towards their perspective and get them to sabotage the change as well. That's my perspective on how we can really understand those people who are going to be critics.
Some of the things I hear are phrases like, we tried that before and it didn't work. And the subtext is, therefore, we may never attempt it again. And you don't think, well, why didn't it work? Was it not the right time, or it wasn't executed well, or, you know, so that's one because I am the person brought in to execute somebody's change. And so I hear that one. And another one I hear is, Tash, what you need to understand is, at insert company name, we do things in a very different way, and we're special and we're unique. And it's like, well, everybody says that, but you're all actually kind of similar. So there's a lot of, you know, yes, maybe that's global best practice and maybe it worked at blah, blah, blah place, but it's not going to work in our organization. So that's another one. But I also think, you know, well, what do you think about, from experience, I think critics, if you can turn them into advocates, because they usually are loud people who talk a lot, and you talked about influencing their peers to be against the change, like, I grab onto those people and I'm like, you're the best friend of the project, because I sit. But, and I also think that sometimes people are critical because they are very passionate about the organization and the customer. So they are, it is coming from a place of care. Like, sometimes it is the things you said, like, people have something to lose, you know, they're losing power or status or something. That's all true. But sometimes I think it's coming from a place of, you know, caring about the customer and caring about the company. And maybe it's suspicion of management, or, you know, if change has been executed badly in the past, there's a lot of things. What are your thoughts on that?
I think you're absolutely right. There are rational, logical reasons that people adopt their approach or their response to change. So we shouldn't be critical of the fact that people are critics. It's reasonable for them to be critical. And because they've experienced poorly led changes or changes that failed, or they've gone through awful turmoil from terrible projects in the past. So clearly we need to communicate really thoughtfully. But as you said, your change critics are the people who are going to really work with you if you can pull them in. So the best ways to get your critics on board are to try and engage them early. So when you're starting to think through who are the different audiences that are affected by this particular project or this particular change, identify your critics early and grab them and pull them towards you. So bring them in, get their contributions, and then get them to help you if possible. This won't always be possible, but 19 out of 20 times, you're going to be able to use your critics as your best allies and get their help in doing things. And of course, we want to make sure that we're as transparent as possible with our critics so that they have context. We also want to make sure, and we've got to do this with all of our different responders or different types of responses to change, explain what we stand to lose if we don't make the change.
Mm.
It's not just about all of the benefits. Benefits are great. You know, all the, you know, these are the nice benefits of the change, but what do we stand to lose if we don't make this change?
Yeah.
Because obviously people are more, well, it's not obvious, but people are more motivated by loss than potential gains.
Mm.
What are your thoughts about some other ways that you've had success with engage critics?
On that one, I think nailing the why is just 100% key, because if people don't understand why we're doing this, they won't get on board, you know? And if I may share a case study of a recent client engagement I had, because also in change, I think there's a bit of, there can be an issue of toxic positivity where we think every change is amazing. But the reality is sometimes people do stand to lose something, not it, like, and there are reasons. So the reason this, I want to share this case study, and I can't say who because NDA, but I worked with a client who was being quite heavily disrupted by some big, big changes in their industry and external environment. And as a result, they were losing money, right? This is why I can't tell you who it is. They had to make some quite difficult strategic decisions to ensure the future and survival of this organization. And it was a not-for-profit organization who was serving people out in the community. And, you know, they had to make some tough choices about what services are we going to offer. And, you know, they had to make a decision to stop offering some services that were causing some of these losses. And that's a real impact. That's much more than losing your job. That's you're no longer going to receive this type of support from this organization. It was shit. Like, you cannot make that not shit, right? It sucks. So what we did, I was working with the CEO and her leadership team. She did a lot of work in the months leading up, like while the board was deliberating, because it was a, they had to go through with, you know, they wanted to be hand on heart. This is the right thing for the organization, because once we do this, you know, people like are going to be moved to other sites. People are, you know, we're they were closing a site and repurposing the building to use it for something else. It's very, you know, new operating model, new org structure, like big stuff. So she had done the CEO a lot of repeating of the messaging about, we are losing money. We are going to have to make some changes. This is not sustainable. We don't know what, you know, what the changes are. But so that was being repeated for several months. So when the announcements came, the staff said, yeah, we've been expecting something like this. We knew the organization was in trouble. So it was not a good change, but it was, if we don't change, we will cease to be an organization, which is very, it is compelling. And then the other thing that was amazing about this client was there was really good feedback about how the communication was handled and how the change was managed. So they managed to do it with a huge amount of empathy and understanding, and people got all the information they needed, and there was a lot of support. So that was really appreciated by the staff and by the people in the community. So there are times when you have a change that is not going to be good for some people, because they will be, you know, losing their friends or losing their role or moving to another team or moving to another site. And you can't sugarcoat that and pretend it's great. So that's probably one tip I would have is you need to acknowledge if something actually isn't a great change, like don't toxic positive it, if that's a word, because that's going to make people annoyed. So you do need to acknowledge if there is something and say, look, this really sucks, you know, but and reinforce the why. I think as well, back to your question about communication, I think making sure that you're communicating often and early and repeating the message so that people are less likely to have that surprise change reaction. So even though, you know, that example was a big org restructure and, you know, new op model, people knew that something was going to be coming because they'd been hearing and understanding the messaging about the problem, right? And I think getting people involved as early as you can and getting people to co-design, because then the change will manage itself because they've had a hand in the change. It's not being done to them, because that's another reason people can take the victim mentality is I wasn't consulted. This is my job. I could tell you this, this, and this. So I think co-design is key as well.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I like that idea of toxic positivity. It's pernicious.
Yeah.
And there are reasons why we might not be positive. I was just reflecting as you were talking about some of the approaches that we can take to the critic. When you think about models like ADKAR, they talk about building desire, but there are situations where we don't have the D, we don't have the desire, and it's unreasonable to think that everyone will want to move in a particular direction. The one thing that we have found is incredibly important is to make sure that there is a clear sense of procedural fairness. Mm. This is what we're doing. Here is the rationale. We are applying these sets of logic to everyone. No one's being targeted out. If there is a burning platform, we're explaining why that's happening. We're explaining what the consequences would be. We're explaining why we're targeting particular areas of the organization. And we're making it really obvious so that we don't get that exacerbated critic mentality. And your suggestions there were great as well. Maybe we'll talk about the bystanders next, though, because I think bystanders are that's the area that I seem to feel most empathy towards in a way. Actually, no, that's the wrong way to put it. It's not empathy towards, but I have the biggest connection with them because I feel like I'm a bit of a bystander.
Yeah. So,
right. So, yeah, when change is coming, oh, yeah, for sure. Mm. But I don't want to make a change. It's of course because brains don't like change. Brains don't want to have to do things differently. We don't want to have to metabolize more than is absolutely necessary. It's not in our evolutionary heritage to want to suddenly have to complicate things. So our thinking on bystanders is that you've got to be exceptionally thoughtful about who is likely to be a bystander and watch out for those bystanders. The best advice that we tend to offer for dealing with bystanders is to give them some sort of really low effort task that is going to begin them on the change journey. So a really low effort task that's going to get them started and then reward them for that low effort task. So if it's logging into a new system, attending some sort of meeting, thank them and let's help them with that next task. So your bystanders, make it something that's easy, low-hanging fruit that they can pick off, and then they're on the journey because they will do anything they can to not participate, to not be involved. What are your experiences with the bystander?
Yeah, so I think the bystander, you've got to be careful because that behavior can be easily missed and misinterpreted. So you've got to be careful that you're not assuming that people are on board when really they're not. So I think as a change agent, you can't, you know, fall into the trap of, oh, I sent the email, we had the meeting, everybody gets it. You've got to really always be like, and you said on the lookout for behaviors, like even if people are exchanging a look or someone's, you know, you can see people are messaging each other or someone's sending each other, you know, I'd be looking for all of that sort of stuff. And I'd probably go in with an assumption that it's going to be like that. So one thing I tell people to do, and this is also in relation to resistors, I say focus on your early adopters or the navigators, because they, and focus on turning your critics into advocates, because if you ignore the critics, and that there was actually something else I wanted to say, but we moved on in the conversation. I think the critics, a lot of the time people want to exclude them from, you know, these co-design type tasks or things like testing, but that is a mistake. They will find every defect. And yeah, it might be a little bit annoying, but it's better than going live with a system full of defects and the customers are finding them, right? So let give them, and then because they're involved, they'll get on board. With the back to the bystanders, though, I think if you focus on your navigators, your early adopters, turning around the critics, there will you will gain a critical mass eventually. And the bystanders will eventually get on board because they will see the change being introduced and they will see it working. And they will begin to understand. I think the worst thing you can do is try and like force people to do things, because then they will be like, and don't try and make people do things when they're not ready to. So I think your example of the low effort task is perfect, because it's low commitment. It's not making them do something that they view to be like a full day training or, you know, something really full on. And the other thing I think is making sure you have your leadership and sponsorship actively role modeling the change. Because if people are doing the bystander passive avoidance thing and they're not seeing any, and they're seeing their leaders do the same thing, that sends a signal that it's, I don't have to. So you need to make sure that you are preparing and coaching leaders to actively role model so that people know this is happening. So another example, I did a, this is one of my very, I wasn't even a change manager then, I was a business analyst. I worked on an ERP implementation at Coca-Cola Amatil, and it was really successful because they had their own people leading and implementing the change. So I was working for a consulting company then, and it was very clear we were supporting. The consultants were not leading it. We were the support. And because they were hearing it from their own people, they were like, I have to do this. This is happening. Like, it was so clear, and it just made the whole thing so much easier, so much easier. And it, you know, that was part of the reason. I mean, obviously there were some bumps in the road, and, you know, when you're doing a big ERP across the manufacturing and warehousing function of a big company, but the leadership and role modeling was not one. We had that, you know, because, and they actually seconded people away from their day jobs to be leading the change. They backfilled the roles. And that's another important thing, is when you are seeking this sort of SME involvement, you need to have your leaders in your organization enabling that. Because what I see so much is people want, you know, we need SMEs for this, we need SMEs for that. But these people also have day jobs, and then they're being asked to come to all these meetings, but nobody's helping them delegate or you know, backfill their position. So again, where I've had the most success is where we've been able to second some resources into a project as analysts, or, you know, given them a project role. So we've got that there, and that person's been backfilled. Because when you've got, you know, a rub and there's a project trying to take someone's time, like the BAU work and their whatever is aligned to their KPIs is always going to win, right? And there's a business to run. So I think, yeah, they're the ones off the top of my head. What more, what else have you got? Like, any other communication or engagement approaches tailored to these sorts of groups?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, just on that piece around time away from BAU or business as usual for your SMEs and other groups, I mean, I think backfilling is super important. So our platform change plan, what we do when we're engaging with or users of the platform, when they're engaging with SMEs or change agents or anyone else that's going to be required to do change activities or change work from a delivery perspective, we just track how much time they're being pulled away from work. And you can do that simply, but then we can provide a clear a heat map in terms of the amount of time away from BAU over the weeks and months. And that gives you clear ability then to backfill. So it's super important for operational teams, just like manufacturing plants that you're dealing with. And in terms of the other strategies, so we talked about the critic, talked about the bystander, big one obviously being the victims. So we need to make sure that those people, as best as is possible, have a clear sense of what's going on. So it's not just using emails and meetings, but every different type of communication mode possible. So newsletters, videos, FAQs, posters everywhere, having someone that they can actually just chat with if possible, a hotline, an email, dedicated email site, anything that you can do to make information available in lots of different ways and keep reinforcing the message. I mean, this is just standard sort of bread and butter, change 101, but it really matters to the victims. We can't sugarcoat anything. So if there will be a change that's going to involve someone's job changing dramatically or no longer being available, we can just give as much information as is possible. We can be as transparent as is possible. Reassure that person as much as is realistic as well. And then just make sure that they've got all the tools that they need. So if there's training that they need, not just offer the training, but make sure that they're actually able to apply the training. I mean, it's clearly important stuff. And just pay particular attention to the victims. Nothing worse than feeling anxious and hypervigilant at work because you don't know what's going on. It's an awful state to be in. I think that kind of fear and anxiety is worse than feeling angry because, you know, anger is something that really motivates critics. Fear is worse than anger. So I would suggest really the most empathy towards our victims where possible. And of course, check in with your victims later on, see what worked for them, use those findings for future changes as well. It's important that you develop an institutional memory for change so that we know what worked last time, what's going to work going forward as well.
Yeah, there's a lot of gold there. And I think making sure that the people who you think may take a victim mentality or feel fear or anxiety, they need to know how they're going to be supported and they need to know what's the process. Because, yeah, I've seen, and this happened to me as a receiver of change, where something big is dropped on people and then there's no info, and then gossip and hearsay can fill the void, which makes it worse. So yeah, you need to make sure, okay, when we're dropping this, you know, surprise or bomb on people, which again, don't do that either. But if you have to, make sure you have all the information ready. Not everyone's going to want it because some people will need to process because they'll be like, okay, that's a lot. And again, if we go back to that restructure, like sometimes when people are hearing the words coming from their manager's mouth, they don't. And that was another feedback item we had from some of the people involved in that organization I talked about. Some of the people said, yeah, I was sitting in the meeting and like I stopped absorbing the information once it got past the first two things. So you also may need to think, okay, people may absorb the top line messaging and the second line. Some people will want all the info and they will take it. So I think it's good. Like, again, in that example, we had printed information packs for everybody to take with them. And that included org charts, FAQs, where to go, you know, the email inbox, where to go for help. So that if they didn't, because it was so much info and it was a surprise, if they weren't able to take it in, they had that with them to go and view later. And then there were regular staff check-in meetings and there was one-on-ones with managers set up to continue that process. And we did find in some subsequent meetings, like people were asking the same questions. And then as new questions were asked, we kept updating the FAQ and sending them out saying, we've got more FAQ, we've got more FAQ. So I think that support piece is critical because if people go, okay, well, this is how I'm going to be supported and I'm going to go to this meeting and then I'm going to get my training, and then they will start to feel excited about it. Because another one that I think can inspire a bit of fear and anxiety is agile transformations. When an organization announces it's going agile, a lot of people think, well, I don't know agile, like this is all brand new to me. There's a big capability gap for me to bridge. What if I don't get there? Like, is there going to be a place for me in the new organization? And that is a very normal response. And once you say to people, all right, this is how we're going to do it, then you can start to get excited about it and become a navigator, right? And go, actually, yeah, I'm feeling pretty good about this. This is a great opportunity for me, you know? But again, you need to have the information there and ready. So preparation and planning is key. And another thing like that popped up when you were talking, and I know I'm really biased, but you've got to get, it was when you were talking about the SMEs and the backfill and, you know, how you were able to kind of really accurately measure that with change plan. This is another reason you need to get change involved at the business case right at the start, because change will be the one saying, how are we going to do this? Have you thought about, because that it obviously comes at a cost, right? And I bump into this all the time where, oh, we can't afford that. That's not in the business case. But a change professional will raise those sorts of questions rather than having those questions coming up at the end. And then, you know, high performing people just get loaded up with more work and it's really stressful, but somehow, you know, we get it over the line. Like, you can make things really great if you just consult your team. And I know I'm preaching to the choir here because I'm sure the people who listen to this podcast agree, but you know, you've got to be thinking about this stuff really early on as well.
Yeah, it's surprising how often organizations don't know how much time away from BAU that people are exposed to, not just from delivery side, but, you know, if they're involved in delivery, but also changes that they are stakeholders of or affected by. And you can show across initiatives, across portfolios, across everything that's going on, here's the impact of all of your projects on people's BAU. You're exceptionally empowered to then make better cases, ask for resources, share results as well.
Another thing I wanted to ask you about was you've done a really interesting piece of research. And you did some research where you surveyed change practitioners and change managers about the types of challenges they face. Could you tell the listeners a little bit about that and what did you find?
Yeah, sure. Thank you. So our organization, Change Plan, has been doing digital trends research over the last 6 years. So asking change managers, what are the things that they feel they could be helped by from a digital perspective? And there are a bunch of key findings. The big piece is that it's difficult to aggregate information from individual projects or initiatives up to portfolio levels and then to enterprise-wide views. Whilst we're great at using spreadsheets, there's lots of spreadsheets that people typically find that they're using. And it's challenging then to make sure that they're all coordinated alongside each other. So the first piece there, difficulty creating that kind of aggregated reporting that they can effortlessly share with leaders.
Yeah.
Spreadsheets there being a key problem. You know, obviously, that one of the reasons we created a platform is to make sure that we've got a system that's as easy to use as Excel, gives you lots of flexibility, but just has everything connected in many-to-many relationships. So just like we can't imagine doing a large-scale project management in Excel anymore. We've got really thoughtful, cleverly created systems like Jira, Microsoft Project, Confluence, all these other great systems. We've got to get smart about this as well with change management. The other big finding is that there's a lot of lack of harmony in terms of the approach in large enterprise. So when you've got 10, 20, 30,000 people in an organization, you're going to have lots of different people doing change differently. And the challenge there is that we don't have any standardized ways of reporting what's going on to senior leaders. You've got contractors coming in and out, which is also problematic because they're bringing their own approach, they're bringing their own ideas, and then they're leaving and you've got these documents, but it's from their own approach. And I mentioned institutional memory earlier. I think that's a big piece for organizations, just creating a sense of here's what was successful in the past. Can we pull from those different change projects? What can we learn? What are the data points that we can make use of? So we need to be building those kinds of repositories of institutional memory that we can share even as we leave the organization. And then the other piece is just organizations don't know what's hitting different audience groups across different initiatives.
Yeah.
And that's a major problem simply because we can't coordinate. I mean, we can, but we can't coordinate effortlessly and in real time between initiatives. So I might be running an initiative, you're running an initiative, and it would be really helpful if I didn't have to call or arrange a meeting with you to know when your activities are hitting the same stakeholders or same audience groups as my activities. If I just saw your calendar of my neighboring projects and said, okay, that's what's happening, all right, I'll just push that a week forward or a week back. Those are the kinds of pieces.
Yeah.
So lots of challenges that people are facing from a digital perspective. We're surprised how long it's taken change managers to digitize because we're so good at helping other people to digitize, you know, with new ERP systems and we're updating this system, that platform. And yet we're using tools that were really built in the 70s and 80s for work that is, it's not appropriate anymore.
Yeah, that's touching a nerve for me, because I have felt that pain so many times, and I have had executives and sponsors and leaders ask me, I want to see all the change and an aggregated view. And I'm like, I don't know.
Yeah, and then this is a big change, right?
Yeah, because I'm one change manager on one project in one part of the business. And I have had an experience where we did do it, but we collected the information manually. So we did have a change manager in each part of the business. And every month we had a head of business meeting where we went through, these are all the changes, but it took each change manager had to contribute to their own projects in their own area. And we had this big heat map PowerPoint, and it was done manually. And because it was done manually, like every month, I think there were errors because somebody was like, oh, I forgot to update this. And, you know, it was a punish, because yeah, every month it's like, oh, we've got the meeting. Oh, we've got to do the blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And yeah, like it took a lot of woman and manpower to actually create. And I thought, God, this is an expensive PowerPoint pack.
Yeah,
and all the heads off, go to the meeting. And yeah.
Yeah, our research is showing it's about 30%. Around 30% of change managers' time is just working on reporting. That's on average. And of course, some people will vary, but that's a tremendous amount of time and effort, and also a huge cost. So we've worked to effectively just mitigate that by just automating everything, just making sure that you've got effortless charting, effortless reporting that can be shared, and then even being able to share just view-only insights for your leaders, creating dashboards that people can just use without then having to speak to you potentially. So you're able to then spend time on what's important, to, you know, interacting with your stakeholder groups and your people, and being strategic.
Wow. Sounds like a dream. It sounds like an absolute dream. Well done.
We're trying. Yes. Working hard.
So good segue is, where can people learn more about Change Plan? And I know you have some free downloads, and you also have a special offer just for Casa de Cambio listeners. So I will put all the info in the show notes, but yeah, just tell us, like, what have you got, and where can people go, and how can people get in touch with you?
Sure. So, I mean, firstly, we're obviously happy to interact with Casa de Cambio. We've created a bunch of resources that we're happy to share with your listeners. So we've got a great activity pack, which is called Stakeholder Playing Cards Activity Pack, that can be used with leaders. It can also be used to educate around change. And it includes the four common responses to change. If you remember, the critic, the bystander, the victim, and the navigator. So that's an awesome download, which you'll have. And it's normally $50, and for you guys, it's free. You can just download that with no problem. So all very exciting. The second piece, if you're interested in having a demonstration of Change Plan, which is our change management application, our platform, which has been deployed across the world in large and small enterprises, we'd be delighted to give you a demonstration. So no obligation. You can check us out at changeplan.co, or just email us at info@changeplan.co, and you can schedule a demonstration. No obligations at all. You might just want to see what's available, what's possible. And I think that's the two main pieces there. So that in terms of the download, the stakeholder playing cards, I'll just rely on you to place that link there if you could.
Yeah, there'll be a special code for listeners, and I'll make sure those are in the show notes for you as well. So enjoy those, listeners. I'm very excited to get my hands on the cards as well. Is there anything else you wanted to share about the topic we've discussed, or anything about, you know, how to engage with stakeholders before we wrap up, Gavin?
Yeah, I mean, I never underestimate the importance of the stakeholder emotional journey. It's a really critical element in making sure that our programs are successful. The reason those four common responses to change model works is because it's simple. You know, it's not necessarily entirely accurate across every change, but it does help leaders understand what to look for, and it reminds us what to look for when we're rolling out new change. The other piece is just remember that everyone has a story. Everyone's going through experiences. Everyone's story is different, so we've just got to have some compassion whilst being very business-oriented at the same time.
Yeah, a little bit of empathy goes a really long way, hey? Well, Gavin, this has been a wonderful chat. I feel like I could talk about responses to change and how we, you know, communicate with people all day, but we've both got jobs that we need to go back to. So thank you so much for being so generous and sharing all of that great knowledge with the Casa de Cambio listeners. And for the listeners, don't forget, if you listen on Apple Podcasts, write a review. I'll go to Change Plan's website and download those playing cards, and I'll be back soon with another great podcast episode. Thank you, Gavin.
Thank you.